after which overall production in the lower 48 dropped steadily, despite all sorts of new tax breaks and breakthroughs in drilling technology. By the time Hubbard died in 1989, he had attracted numerous disciples, many grouped in a professional organization called the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, ASPO, who applied his basic methodology to other regions and nations. In Alaska, production peaked in 1988. In Canada and Mexico, during this decade. Output in the former Soviet Union, which first peaked in 1985 to 1987, was the subject of considerable disagreement 2 decades later. Both major North Sea producers are said to have maximized output, Norway in 2004 and Britain in 2000, even though local drilling began only in the 1970s. A short explanation of the peak concept is in order. Geologists define it as the point at which at least half of a field's reachable oil has been extracted. After this stage, getting each barrel out requires more pressure, more expense, or both. Output shrinks accordingly. After a while, despite nominal reserves that may be considerable, more energy is required to find and extract a barrel of oil than the barrel itself contains. By then, production becomes uneconomic. At least until the price of oil rises or the cost of extraction drops. Although the experts do not agree how close world oil production is to its peak, pessimists believe that it is close, and even relative optimists see it only 2 or 3 decades away. Matthew Simmons, a Texas consultant who has advised George W. Bush's White House, pinpointed the aging problem in a 2002 report, The World's Giant Oil Fields, for the Colorado School of Mines. The 120 largest oil fields produce close to 33 million barrels a day, almost 50% of the world's crude oil supply. The 14 largest account for over 20%. The average age of these 14 largest fields is 43.5 years. By 2004, Simmons and others were expressing concern that Saudi output might already have peaked. Unconfirmable, of course, until seen later in the all-knowing rearview mirror. 2004 was also the year that Royal Dutch Shell acknowledged overstating its oil and gas reserves by 20%, bringing a major plunge in its share price. British Petroleum had downgraded its production goals several times during 2002, said analysts, because it couldn't find enough oil in its existing fields. To all the major oil companies, finding new production resources was a never-ending challenge. John Thompson, the president of ExxonMobil Exploration, wrote in a 2003 company publication, "We estimate that world oil and gas production from existing fields is declining at an average rate of about 4 to 6% a year. To meet projected demand in 2015, the industry will have to add about 100 million oil-equivalent barrels a day of new production. That's equal to about 80% of today's production level. In other words, by 2015, we will need to find, develop, and produce a volume of new oil and gas that is equal to 8 out of every 10 barrels being produced today." The year 2005, with its high oil prices, brought more candor about future supplies from the major oil companies and the press, if not from the Bush administration. "Big oil warns of coming energy crunch," reported the headline in the Financial Times. In a new advertisement, ExxonMobil acknowledged that the world faces enormous energy challenges. There are no easy answers. Meanwhile, a company publication, The Outlook for Energy, a 2030 view, predicted that oil production outside OPEC would peak in just 5 years. Chevron Chief Executive Officer David J. O'Reilly told a Houston audience that in the new international energy equation, relative to demand, oil is no longer in plentiful supply. The time when we could count on cheap oil and even cheaper natural gas is clearly ending. Major financial institutions with oil exposure, like Deutsche Bank and the Bank of Montreal, began to take sides in the peak oil debate or endorse the case that Saudi oil production had probably peaked, with all that implied for the future. In a similar vein, prominent figures in the industry began to acknowledge that new oil discoveries were languishing. Arthur Smith, Chairman of John S. Herald Incorporated Consultants, noted that recent data show the number of major oil discoveries continues to decline each year. We are living off inventory. That's confirmed by all the data we've collected on the industry. Several months earlier, Petroleum Review editor Chris Skrabowski had reported similar study findings, that among 18 nations providing 30% of the world's daily crude oil output, production was declining at a rate of 5% a year, and those procedures still with expansion potential are having to work harder and harder to make up for the accelerating losses of the large number that have clearly peaked and now are in continuous decline. When the informational dam broke, candor came in a flood. Some models predicted that the production of non-OPEC countries, including the United States, Britain, Canada, Russia, Norway, Mexico, and Angola, would collectively peak around 2010. This implied a future concentration of pricing leverage in the OPEC states, led by Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf countries, where the collective peak is thought to be further off. By 2025, OPEC might control a large portion of the remaining reserves. Not surprisingly, speculation about Saudi production itself peaking brought quick rejoinders from Riyadh. Yet important doubts had been planted, and they were kept alive in 2005 when the Saudis could not increase production enough to keep prices from soaring. Critics of Hubbert's methodology raised valid caveats, that major reserves were larger than realized, and still increasing through new discoveries, and that a combination of high prices and increasingly sophisticated extraction techniques should make it economic to pursue higher rates of recovery from existing deposits. New drills, they pointed out, could reach depths of 10 miles, move in any direction, and even detect oil and gas electronically. Deep water drilling has excited particular expectations, and some have cast their eyes toward the Arctic preserves. Peak theorists countered that politicians, government agencies, and OPEC leaders all have major vested interests in soothing worries about the need for crash programs to find oil substitutes. Note was made that back in 1985, many OPEC nations had inflated their estimated oil reserves because doing so allowed them to increase their production quotas. The optimism of official agencies such as the U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, and the Energy Information Agency, in turn, was suspect because of their responsiveness to White House pressure. As far back as 1919, the USGS released gloomy estimates of U.S. production, by some accounts to justify the American case for sharing in the post-World War I division of Ottoman Empire oil. In 1973, Congress called for an investigation of the USGS for not anticipating or drawing attention to the U.S. oil production peak of 1970. However, even in these government circles, optimists put the peak of global oil production only a bit closer to the middle of the century, say 2025 to 2035, than to its beginning. That still left the United States of 2025 in the difficult position of needing to import roughly three-quarters of an expected 30 million barrels per day of consumption. At the same time, environmental experts emphasized yet another aging process. The global climate change caused by 20th century manufacturing and energy consumption, which overloaded the atmosphere with carbon dioxide. An abrupt climate change scenario, released by the Pentagon in 2003 but quickly disavowed by the White House, discussed the potential peril to U.S. national security from rising world energy consumption and the likelihood of resource wars. In the 1980s, as natural gas assumed a greater role in the United States alongside oil, geologists identified a Hubbert peak for U.S. gas production around 1989. By 2000, the cautions from Texas had escalated. Oil and Gas Journal reported in 1999 that the Texas gas industry, with one-third of the nation's production, had to drill 6,400 new wells just to maintain output, in contrast to 4,000 new ones the year before, and the Associated Press reported similar ratios nationally. 2 decades earlier, offshore drillers in the Gulf of Mexico had frequently found large gas reservoirs of 100 billion cubic feet or more, but by 2002, discoveries averaged only 5% of that size. Within the United States, the infrastructure for transporting natural gas made hardly anyone happy. Short pipelines are one thing, but carriage over long distances is a challenge. Considerably more expensive than moving oil because the gas must be liquefied and carried under pressure. Some Washington policymakers looked for rescue to Canada, Mexico, and the North American Free Trade Agreement. Although rising oil prices made large-scale but high-cost extraction from Alberta's oil sands increasingly economic, getting more natural gas to the United States from Canada's Mackenzie Delta faced other obstacles. The pipeline needed cost $20 billion and was opposed by the Canadian provinces and Aboriginal tribes whose lands would be crossed. The larger dilemma is that North America doesn't have much of the world's natural gas reserves. Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa dominate, although the United States alone has been consuming 25% of the world's annual output. Embattled American oil and automobile Goliaths and the premise of Middle Eastern rescue. Age and longevity can be rewarded in America, but they do not favor the oil giants. Despite the huge profits record oil prices bestowed on the two remaining U.S. oil giants, their weaker international circumstances can be glimpsed in lost rankings. In the 1930s and 1940s, five of the seven sisters that dominated international oil were American. Now only ExxonMobil, 2, and Chevron, 7, both of which gained needed scope through 1999 mergers, fly the stars and stripes. The other eight are Saudi Aramco, 1, the National Iranian Oil Corporation, 3, Petróleos de Venezuela, 4, British Petroleum and Royal Dutch Shell, tied for 5, total 8, Pemex, 9, and PetroChina, 10. Four of the 10 are government-owned oil companies created by various reorganizations and nationalizations. Pemex, formerly Petróleos Mexicanos, 1938, the National Iranian Oil Corporation, 1979, Petróleos de Venezuela, 1976, and Saudi Aramco, 1980. PetroChina, principally state-owned, is the largest oil company in the People's Republic. That gives Asia and Latin America 5 out of the top 10, a major comedown for the former seven sisters. From the 1930s to the 1960s, the seven counted much of this oil production their own, but when nationalization spread across the Middle East and Latin America, the share of global oil reserves held by the four American and British giants fell to just 4% in 2001. Not surprisingly, the companies deeply resent this turnabout and would like to see it reversed by privatization, especially in the Middle East. In the 1960s, commentators described the big American and British firms as integrated oil companies because they controlled the whole sequence of production from oil field to pump. But the rise of the rival state-owned companies over the last four decades prompted some U.S. analysts to coin a new term for the Western behemoths: obsolescent supermajors. Forced into seeking more strength through mergers during the 1990s, the resulting megafirms, also including French Total, soon found themselves consumed with the challenge of replacing every million barrels sold with a freshly discovered million. Finding small fish was not enough. The behemoths needed the latter-day equivalent of giant sperm whales, and the hunting grounds were shrinking. Experts saw only a few options. The majors could tilt more toward natural gas, made easier because overseas gas producers had no OPEC-type quotas to constrain output. Alternatively, they could hope to gain oil resources by relying on Washington pressure to break up the state-owned firms guarding the spigots in the Persian Gulf. In the years before the 2003 U.S. invasion left Iraq's oil production in disarray from disrepair and insurgent attacks, ExxonMobil and Chevron had both smacked their lips over sharing access. ExxonMobil, foreign observers reported, hoped to get the Majnoon field with its 20 to 25 billion barrels. As early as 1995, the Wall Street Journal reported a consensus that Iraq, with its huge resources and very low production costs, was the biggie in terms of future production and oil firm global pecking order. Those stakes took dollar form in early 2004 when the New York-based Global Policy Forum published calculations of how much the U.S. and U.K. oil giants stood to make from control over Iraqi oil reserves, estimated at close to 400 billion barrels. In order to understand the magnitude of these profits, it is useful to know that the worldwide profits of the world's five largest private oil companies in 2002 were $35 billion. Our estimate of the most probable annual profits in Iraq are $95 billion, three times this sum. Even if these estimates were too high, Iraq had become shorthand for oil company salvation. With the giants caught up by a kind of assets inertia similar to that of British coal and railroading in their own heydays, transformations appeared daunting. In his book, The End of Oil, Paul Roberts opined that from the standpoint of an oil company's long-term profitability, this inability to hit targets or replace reserves is akin to a diagnosis of cancer, and the industry knows it. The market now watches company production numbers and so-called reserves to production ratios, or how many years a company's reserves will last, as closely as it used to watch profits. Clearly, the potential multiplier of the stock prices, market capitalization, of ExxonMobil, Chevron, Royal Dutch Shell, and BP from dividing up Iraq's resources stood to be a cork popper. Before leaving this discussion of the oil companies, it is relevant to touch on the industry's aging workforce problem. Gray hair is in this year, Larry Nation of the American Association of Petroleum Geologists told the Houston Chronicle in 2004. There simply aren't younger geologists to take on the job. It's like a slow-moving train wreck, and here it is. The reasons given included distrust of oil and gas as a boom-bust business, belief that it is an old guy's business and environmentally unsound, and unwillingness by families to relocate to obscure and sometimes dangerous places in the third world. However, Stephen Holditch, a former president of the Society of Petroleum Engineers, said these American views did not apply in Africa, Latin America, and Russia. In Cairo, he said, they're jumping at the chance. On the positive side, at least the oil firms did not confront the legacy problems, the crippling hangover of pension and health costs that had begun to dog the competitiveness of yesteryear's automobile and airline industry stalwarts. At General Motors, for example, each current worker supports 2.4 retirees, an ultimately unsustainable equation. For now, the oil industry is too rich to have that particular problem. The aging of the U.S. electricity supply and power grid, serious as it is, can be put to one side as we concentrate on the aging of the American oil culture. Electricity is small stuff next to transportation. Cars and trucks burn an overwhelming 2 out of every 3 barrels of oil used in the United States. Airplanes use another 10%. Power plants, by contrast, are only minor oil burners, as of 1998 being 56% coal-fired, 21% nuclear-driven, 10% gas-burning, and 10% hydroelectric. The critical yardstick of an adequate U.S. oil supply, or any turn toward efficiency and conservation, must be automotive. ExxonMobil's grandparent, Standard Oil, would have been 130 years old as the century turned in 2000. Ford was 97 and General Motors 92. Their old age, much less secure, was succinctly summarized by the New York Times in 2005. Ford and GM, the last two predominantly American-owned automakers, have been struggling to compete against Asian and European rivals. Both have been losing market share despite heavy spending on rebates, and both are weighed down by soaring health care and pension costs. Standard & Poor's has the debt of Ford and GM rated one notch above junk bonds, a precarious position for two of the largest corporate borrowers. By the end of 2005, their bonds had fallen into junk status. Union labor contracts are part of the vice. Wall Street analysts use enormous legacy cost burden language to explain why the two firms would rather produce extra vehicles than idle plants temporarily. If you can generate some contribution to cover those legacy costs, said analyst Marianne Keller, you will spend money on incentives in order to keep the production lines running. It is more expensive to close the production lines and have people idle. Remember, if the production line is closed, not only do those legacy pension and health costs continue, but also the workforce that is temporarily unemployed receives 95% of their normal wages. According to one study by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the U.S. automobile industry shows the effects of pension costs on the bottom line. The results of a Prudential financial study state that pension and retiree benefits represent $631 of the cost of every Chrysler vehicle, $734 of the cost of every Ford vehicle, and $1,360 of the cost of every GM car or truck. In contrast, an article in the Detroit Free Press reported that pension and retiree benefit costs per vehicle at the U.S. plants of Honda and Toyota are estimated to be $107 and $180, respectively. Longevity and diminished competitiveness went hand in hand. Predictions mounted that Toyota would soon replace GM as the world's leading carmaker. Inside Ford and GM, meanwhile, the biggest profits are made not by the manufacturing segment, but by the two financial arms, Ford Credit and General Motors Acceptance Corporation, GMAC. Both are giants in the accounts receivable world. At Ford, the nuts and bolts automotive sector made $850 million before taxes in 2004, while Ford Credit racked up a record pre-tax profit of nearly $5 billion. Both companies' credit subsidiaries, it must be added, go beyond auto loans to services ranging from leases to mortgages and money market instruments. The new bottom line, one could argue, is that manufacturing results have given way. Actual production of goods has become the showroom for a loan origination business. In 1986, Salomon Brothers forecast exactly this kind of era in which credit operations would be the lucrative side of the business. Without that financial backstop, the two firms might have become historical artifacts by the end of the 20th century. The irony is that during the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s, the automaking Big Three worked to push the U.S. transportation system into car dependence. Led by GM, the automakers acquired bus manufacturers and lines, then promoted diesel buses to displace both intercity rail transportation and electric transit systems. GM also acquired railroad engine manufacturers, converting their production from electric trains, the norm in 1935, to trains that by 1970 were almost wholly diesel-run. According to Foes, while GM made some money from diesel buses and railroad engines, the larger purpose was to channel the public toward car purchases, where the huge profits lay. Critics often exaggerate, but this case seems broadly supportable. In recent years, ironically, the sales of small and cheaper cars in the United States, once the preoccupation of Henry Ford's Model T culture and GM's early Chevrolet marketing, has slipped into foreign hands. Late in 2003, Toyota passed Chrysler in overall monthly sales, and the GM-Ford-Chrysler market share of all U.S. vehicle sales dropped to under 60%. The overall U.S. market share of GM alone dropped to under 30% from more than twice that in 1970. Of the compact and mid-size cars sold in 2003, 45% and 39%, respectively, were imports, principally Japanese. Limited intercity rail and urban mass transit facilities mean that little of the automobile demand can be diverted that way. Vulnerable automakers have spent much of the last three decades dodging potentially fatal bullets. In the late 1970s and 1980s, Chrysler was bailed out by a federal loan, while Ford was kept afloat by the deep pockets of its founding family. In the 1990s, SUVs mounted the rescue, and in the 2000s, the job was achieved by lucrative financial units, despite costly rebates and interest-free loans to keep the public buying. Whether the automakers will exist a decade or two hence may matter less than the nature of the forces that will chop them down or repackage their surviving parts. The financial side certainly has hazards, in that both GM and Ford borrowed huge sums in the low-interest bond market in recent years to plug holes in their pension funds and fund the costs of their vital incentive plans. Skeptics pictured a pyramid of credit risk, vulnerable to an interest rate crunch that could leave the car companies shut out of unsecured borrowing. On the manufacturing front, both companies might have gone under had they not found the SUV loophole in the mid-1980s. As Japanese manufacturers figuratively ate Detroit's lunch, Ford and GM survived by shifting ever more of their production into SUVs and other light trucks that were, one, exempt from the U.S. fuel efficiency standards applied to automobiles, and two, profitable to a critical degree, even though such vehicles were so heavy in carbon dioxide emissions as to have a limited market in other countries. Through these choices, the automobile companies have painted themselves into a strategic corner. In 2003, the Washington-based World Resources Institute published a survey in which chart after chart showed the manufacturers that are rooted in the U.S. market, Ford, GM, and Daimler Chrysler, turning out most of their sales volume in SUVs and heavy cars and scoring worst in carbon dioxide emissions. The Institute's ultimate measurement, the carbon intensity of each automaker's profits, showed that Ford and GM derive more than three-quarters of their profits from high carbon-emitting vehicles because their profits are disproportionately attributable to light truck sales. To a considerable extent, the U.S. automobile company's tight corner is also America's. More than most other industries, the surviving U.S.-owned manufacturers are vulnerable to negative economic and energy changes. Should oil and gasoline prices further implode the U.S. domestic SUV and large car market, imperiling domestic manufacturers, ever more of the smaller cars Americans drive will be foreign-made, worsening a U.S. global trade imbalance already inflamed by the surging cost of oil imports. The nation's once proud auto culture could turn into yet another framework for escalating U.S. global indebtedness. The 2006 to 2008 politics looks to be confrontational. Unless the Bush administration can submerge the problems facing U.S. automobile manufacturers, motorists, and daily commuters in some new and successful foreign diversion, U.S. mismanagement in Iraq having only aggravated the oil supply and terrorist threats, the political dependence of the Republican National Coalition on automobiles, gasoline, and drivers stands to be a battleground. During the first George W. Bush administration, that reliance dictated an attempt to turn the Persian Gulf into an American filling station so as to maintain high energy consumption. During the second, disillusioned constituencies became visibly at risk. Chapter 2. The Politics of American Oil Dependence. Oil provides a unique springboard for analyzing the American society and the problems of power that it poses. Robert Engler, The Politics of Oil, 1961. Oil is a kind of original sin in American politics. It's a big, messy, sometimes dirty business, and it has touched everyone and everything in our political system, from the days of the Rockefellers to Bush and Gore. David Ignatius, The Washington Post, 2000. What makes the new Bush administration different from previous wealthy cabinets is that so many of the officials have links to the same industry. Oil. BBC News, January 2001. The glory of the 20th century is now the burden. Oil has soaked deeply, in all likelihood indelibly, into the politics and power structure of the United States, partly because over two bountiful centuries it has also seeped, spouted, and oozed up from so many sections of so many states. More than a fuel, oil became a heritage and also the basis of a lifestyle. In the 1920s, Bruce Barton, an advertising man who became a Republican congressman from New York, described gasoline as the juice of the fountain of youth, a national revivifier through the excursions and explorations it made possible. 80 years later, oil still stands for American independence and fulfillment. Politics has reflected this association. For all the intermittent popular arousal against the creeping, crawling black monster of Standard Oil and later against Big Oil, there is also a sense of bounty. Hundreds of local petrocultures, blending entrepreneurialism and folk history, have underpinned the towering concentrations of wealth and influence built during America's global oil hegemony. And tower that wealth has. Fully half of the 16 richest U.S. companies in 1948 were oil firms. A generation later, the initial Forbes survey of the 400 richest Americans, 1982, set out the largest personal and family fortunes. Of the top 30, more than half had origins in petroleum, America's black gold. As for the millions of small stakeholders, the oil-stained yeomanry of the Allegheny, Pecos, or Williston basins, and the mere part-timers making $50 or $100 per month from the output of a derrick or two, their contribution was to lobby hard in Cheyenne, Topeka, or Baton Rouge, and pose for group photographs published in the inside pages of the Mid-Continent Gas and Oil Association monthly as evidence of grassroots commitment. At the grassroots, oil rarely gushed, but it frequently trickled modest to middling reward. 20th century Oklahomans saw more than 750,000 wells drilled, with oil struck in 72 of 77 counties. A half dozen Los Angeles neighborhoods played host to more derricks than palm trees, and on most days, nearby Huntington Beach counted more drillers than bathers. When Senator Paul Douglas from Prairie, Illinois, where winter blew cold, led a 1954 fight against the oil depletion allowance, the industry's cherished federal income tax break, advisors cautioned that even in that corn-cribbed state, more than one-third of the counties had gas or oil production. Politicians found ratios just as high in Montana, Kansas, and Kentucky. In 10 or 15 states, many Atlantic, oil and gas deposits were virtually non-existent. From Maine to Florida, hints of offshore drilling were shouted down as a threat to fisheries, lobsters, and tourism. New England officeholders, in particular, have been ready to blame the Sun Belt for fuel oil costs, which has prompted Texans to respond with caustic bumper stickers: "Drive fast, freeze a Yankee." Nationally, support for the industry outweighed opposition, in as much as 20 to 30 states counted oil and gas as a middling to big business, a proud part of local history, or both. Moreover, when the pride and self-interest of the American automobile culture are added to the commerce of energy, as politically they must be, the balance of power has been as unmistakable as the torque of a 1970s Cadillac or the blessing of air conditioning in summer traffic jams. Environmentalists raise a credible voice, but usually a less influential one. Voters have come to expect cheap gasoline, electricity, and gas and oil heating, as well as the comfort, mobility, and personal independence that hydrocarbons facilitate. Americans constitute the world's most intensive motoring culture. For reasons of history and past abundance, no other national population has clumped so complacently around so fuelish a lifestyle. For many citizens, the century of oil has brought surfeit, gas-guzzling mobile fortresses, family excursions on 20,000 gallons per hour jet aircraft, and lavishly lit McMansions in glittering, mall-packed exurbs along outer beltways. Against a backdrop of declining national oil and gas output, Americans consume 25% of world energy while holding just 5% of its energy resources. As the new century began, Americans enjoyed a lifestyle roughly twice as energy-intensive as those in Europe and Japan, some 10 times the global average. Of the world's 520 million automobiles, unsurprisingly, more than 200 million were driven in the United States, and the U.S. car population was increasing at 5 times the rate of the human population. How long that could continue was not clear. John and Jane Q. Citizen mostly ignore these trends and details, and know nothing of geologist Hubbard's bell-shaped charts of peak oil. Senior oil executives sometimes discuss them in industry conferences, but elected officials, many with decades of energy platitudes under their belts, typically shrink from opening what would be a Pandora's box of political consequences. Oil was there for our grandfathers, they insist, and it will be there for our grandchildren. It is part of the American way. The politics of oil dependence in the United States, in sum, is ingrained and possessive. A culture of red, white, and blue assumptions of entitlement. A foreign policy steeped in covert petroleum emphasis and a machismo philosophy of invade and take it. But before pursuing these cultural aspects, we must examine the political infrastructure. Oil's growing influence on party politics and the presidency, together with the uniquely powerful role it has played in U.S. foreign policy over the years. The emergence of oil and U.S. party politics. Almost from its birth, the industry put conspicuous political muscle on display in its home region, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia. Oliver Hazard Payne, a wealthy Cleveland refiner and early ally of John D. Rockefeller, rose during the 1870s to become treasurer of Standard Oil, supervising the Ohio-based company's financial liaisons with federal and state politicians. This was an era infamous for the easy equation of money and power. In 1884, Payne is said to have handed out enough to convince the Democratic Ohio legislature to send his father, Congressman Harry Payne, rather than some other party stalwart, to the U.S. Senate. 4 years earlier, Standard had helped elect to the U.S. Senate a friendly West Virginia oil man, Johnson N. Camden, whose company, renamed Consolidated Oil, had already been secretly bought out by Rockefeller. Camden, too, was a Democrat. Like most other magnates, Rockefeller sought friends in both parties. As for Republican Pennsylvania, reformer Henry Demarest Lloyd sardonically and famously observed that Standard had managed to do everything with the state legislature but refine it. Access and power flourished, although by the 1890s the Rockefeller fortune, relentlessly attacked by muckraking journalists, had become the nation's most controversial. In party terms, the Pennsylvania and Ohio oil lands sat in Republican regions, but beginning in 1901, geology favored existing or soon-to-be-admitted Democratic states with the gushers at Spindletop and major finds in Oklahoma and Louisiana. By the time Franklin D. Roosevelt ran for the White House in 1932, even grander fields had opened up in eastern Texas, ensuring that state's future as America's top oil and gas producer. This geography may have influenced Roosevelt to select crusty Speaker of the House, John Nance Garner of Texas, as his running mate. Ironically, the New Deal coalition came undone 36 years later under the first Texas-bred president, Lyndon Johnson. For the liberalizing National Democratic Party, Johnson's oil ties turned out to be a lagging, not leading, indicator. Oil's bipartisan geography ensured the industry power regardless of party control in Washington. The East Texas discoveries of 1930 to 1931, followed by a 1932 to 1933 glut and price collapse, led to petroleum becoming a major preoccupation come beneficiary of the New Deal. In 1926, Washington Republicans had jumped the oil depletion allowance from a piddling 5% to a lucrative 27.5%, but they also dropped top federal income tax rates low enough to mute the rewards of the allowance. The Democratic Congresses of the 1930s, herded along by tough Texan trail bosses, kept the high allowance and liberalized it. Meanwhile, the maximum federal income tax rate rose to 91%. A cross-hatching of liability, shelter, and relief that revalidated oil's nickname of black gold. Many oilmen, especially Texans and Southerners, but even some in the Rockefeller apparatus, backed Roosevelt in his first race when oil needed help. Coal interests generally stuck with the GOP, which increased Democratic openness to oil. In addition to the depletion allowance, New Deal collaboration included price supports for oil and import restrictions. Roosevelt also signed so-called hot oil legislation. Pushed by the big companies, this 1935 statute prohibited interstate oil transfers, typically by small shippers, at prices below those set by state regulators. Between them, state and federal regulation created something of a maze. Eventually, oil imports from abroad would be managed through a two-tier system in which U.S. producers received considerably more than the per-barrel price set in global markets. Because a boom or bust commodity like oil required some regulation to minimize gluts and price collapses, a degree of government involvement was critical. Further, World War I had already illustrated oil's national security importance. Liberals and reformers howled at favoritism, usually castigating the federal tax breaks, so lucrative that they often put wealthy oilmen on the defensive. Oklahoma Senator Robert Kerr, the multimillionaire head of Kerr-McGee Oil and, for a brief time in the 1950s, a presidential hopeful, wryly pitched an audience of skeptical border state farmers by stating his respect for the right of any American to be against any racket he isn't in on. Oil state members of Congress kept the machinery in good repair. The historian Robert Caro noted that even before Roosevelt became president, Texans were elected on December 7, 1931, not only to the speakership of the House, but to the chairmanships of five of its most influential committees. Lyndon Johnson's first day in the Capitol was the day Texas came to power in it, a power the state was to hold with only the briefest interruptions for more than 30 years. Beyond Capitol Hill, other federal pressure was usually suspect. By World War II, Texas oilmen were lamenting incipient socialism in the regulatory approach of Roosevelt and the executive branch. The Democratic share of the presidential vote in upper-income Houston precincts, tabulated by analyst Samuel Lovell in 1956, mirrored the souring petroleum club mindset. A grateful 57% in 1936, then a slump to 29% in 1940, 18% in 1944, 7% in 1948, and 6% in 1952. Texas oilmen were learning to whisper Republican nationally, even if they still spoke Democratic, in Tyler, Temple, or Fort Worth. The state remained the top U.S. oil and gas producer through the entire 1932 to 1968 New Deal political cycle, and most years thereafter, riding one socioeconomic updraft after another, although not in California's league. Between 1930 and 1970, per capita income in Texas gained on the national average while remaining slightly below it. Meanwhile, population climbed. From fifth place nationally in 1930, the Lone Star State nearly doubled its headcount and had climbed to fourth by 1970, while northern states slipped. Notwithstanding local free enterprise breastbeating, the federal spending that came Texas's way was an especially vital gravy train. So was oil's increasing centrality to the national economy. Between 1930 and 1946, the annual U.S. consumption of petroleum products roughly tripled to 1.8 billion barrels, and then rose threefold again to 5.4 billion barrels in 1971. During this developmental spurt, petroleum became the feedstock for the production of paints, plastics, pharmaceuticals, and textile fibers, and it furnished the gasoline for the automobile age and the suburbanization of America, with all of its housing developments, malls, and office buildings. The aerospace and aviation industries, closely tied to military spending and tourism, also ran on petroleum. Because of this oil-based ascendancy over the rest of the world, mirroring innovation as well as profligacy, the United States by 1955 was using more than one-third of the annual global energy output. Indeed, at this peak of America's post-war global advantage, U.S. per capita energy consumption was fully six times that of the next ranking nation. The quarter century after 1945 marked the apogee of the American car culture. Most males of an age still remember Kaisers, Nashes, DeSotos, and Packards, and recall the various big oil companies by their free road maps and snappy promotional images. Saucony Mobil's red-winged Pegasus, Amoco's flaming torch, Shell's orange scallop shell, Sinclair's emerald brontosaurus, and so on. And behind the symbols purred giant profit centers. In 1919, only four oil companies had made the U.S. top 16 ranked by assets: Standard Oil of New Jersey, Esso, Saucony, Gulf, and Sinclair. By 1935, the number had doubled to eight. Esso, 1, Saucony, 4, Standard Oil of Indiana, 5, SoCal, 10, Texaco, 11, Gulf, 12, Shell, 15, and Sinclair, 16. And the roll call for 1948 was quite similar. Pump side appeal humanized the remote corporate behemoths. And a half century later, the service station clutter and auto showroom sparklers of the 40s and the 50s, evoking nostalgia, had become the objects of an upscale collector's market. Behind oil stood the rest of the corporate auto culture. Of the other 8 top U.S. corporations at mid-century, 5 manufactured vehicles: autos, trucks, tractors, or their steel frames. Gasoline, oil, and the internal combustion engine were kings of the road, and the world's best highway system was their palace parade grounds. If the oil industry in America had 2 seemingly placid golden decades, domestically and globally, they were the 1950s, especially, and the 1960s, despite gathering storm clouds. After 1970, oil nationalizations in the Middle East and the rise of OPEC wrote a new script. Oil was to gain a degree of influence on the White House unimaginable in 1959 or 1965. Oil's strengthening grip on the American presidency. The man in the White House from 1953 to 1961, former General and World War II Allied Supreme Commander Dwight D. Eisenhower, provided an early hint of the accession to come. He had been born in oil country, Denison, in north central Texas, although he grew up in eastern Kansas. The 34th president was also a lifelong advocate of the internal combustion engine. As a young Army officer who had earlier commanded a tank training unit, Eisenhower helped to lead a mid-1919 Washington to California motorcade of some 81 cars, trucks, mobile repair shops, and motorcycles. Partly funded by Willys, Packard, Mack, and General Motors, some of whose test vehicles came along, the expedition's purpose was to display the growing prowess of motor transport and publicize the need for 2-lane highways. Indeed, records showed that poor roads limited the convoy to an average of 58 miles per day and an average speed of 6 miles per hour. But millions of voters and politicians were impressed. 33 years later, as the 1952 Republican presidential nominee, Eisenhower swept all the southern oil centers from West Texas to the Mississippi River Delta, the first GOP candidate to do so. Once in office, he followed through on his campaign promise to support the jurisdictional claims of California and the Gulf Coast states to offshore or tidelands oil. Most fitting of all, he presided over the massive expansion of America's post-war interstate highway program, now officially the Dwight D. Eisenhower Interstate Highway System. Among his cabinet appointees were a Texas oil executive, Robert B. Anderson, as Secretary of the Treasury, and a Detroit Automobile Company president, Engine Charlie Wilson of General Motors, as Secretary of Defense. The new national party politics of oil was beginning to cohere. Even so, the regional split, a typical Texas executive, for example, cast Republican ballots at the national level but supported local Democrats for Congress, would stick until the 1960s, when Richard Nixon, Eisenhower's vice president, sought to complete the transformation. He had narrowly lost Texas in his first presidential race in 1960 because of the home state muscle of Lyndon Johnson as the vice presidential nominee. Then he finished slightly short again in 1968, although winning nationally. Like much of the press, Nixon credited the influence of the retiring Texas Democratic president, as well as the state-level exertions of Johnson's longtime chief lieutenant, John B. Connally, then Texas's popular Democratic governor. Between them, Johnson and Connally had close ties to most of the state's oil-connected power brokers: Clint Murchison, the Richardson-Bass family, George Brown, and many others. To co-opt this element, realignment was needed, and Nixon reached the White House with a prairie-sized complex about Texas. Nixon had an oil state childhood himself, the makings of a classic love-hate relationship. Biographers have emphasized his campaign contributions dating back to the 1940s from oil forces such as the reclusive Howard Hughes, Standard Oil of California, SoCal, and Los Angeles-based Union Oil. However, the 37th president was also personally molded by an oil boom. In the rich eastern fields of the Los Angeles basin of the 1920s, much like the roaring milieu that had bred the Texas Democrats. Few other Republican politicians could say the same. Some background is in order. In 1903, California overtook Texas as the nation's leading oil producer, and it was to do so again several times during the 1910s and the 1920s. In 1919, Nixon's father, Frank, left his unsuccessful Lemon Grove and for several years worked as a roustabout for Union Oil. In 1921, Union struck the huge Santa Fe Springs find near the Nixon family homes in Yorba Linda and later Whittier. Before long, Santa Fe Springs and two other fields in the Los Angeles basin, Signal Hill and Huntington Beach, had again pushed California ahead of Texas. Booming Los Angeles became the world's biggest oil port, while related traffic through the Panama Canal boomed. In his everyday travels, the young Nixon would have whiffed occasional oil and gas fumes, and locally that smell connoted oil Dorado. In 1924, when Nixon was 11, oil surpassed agriculture as the state's leading industry. By itself, the Los Angeles basin that year produced 230 million barrels of crude oil and 300 billion cubic feet of natural gas. Not far from Nixon's home, an overenthusiastic developer named a subdivision Petroleum Gardens. "The nearest gushers and pumps," wrote one chronicler, "could sometimes be heard from Yorba Linda, an audible drum of prosperity and sometimes sudden riches thumping over the quiet tract with its struggling or aborted lemon groves." Like the citrus Gold Coast, oil seemed a miracle within ordinary reach. Though oil was never discovered on the hill, both Nixon's mother Hannah and Richard would tell writers that a strike had come after they left, and that the family might have been wealthy. Instead, the 1920s in-crowd at Whittier High School, teenagers whose Hacienda Country Club parents represented minor Santa Fe Springs oil money, paid little attention to the awkward outsider who carried away the memory. Nixon recalled absorbing, as a boy, some of his populist father's anger at Standard Oil and enthusiasm for 1924 progressive presidential nominee Robert La Follette. Nevertheless, as a young lawyer in the late 1930s and later as a successful GOP candidate for Congress and the U.S. Senate, Nixon took the supportive positions expected of the typical Republican nominee in an oil-rich section of oil-rich Southern California. As president, though, he sometimes acted contrary to industry views. For example, he cut the oil depletion allowance, considered scrapping the oil import restrictions backed by the big companies, and approved both price controls on oil in 1971 and their renewal in 1973. Nixon likewise signed a wide variety of environmental legislation. Also, his belated proposal to meet the growing national energy crisis, set out in a November 1973 energy independence message, included far-reaching conservation measures like Sunday gas station closings and a federal speed limit of 55 miles per hour. Nixon's preoccupation was not with the history or details of energy policy, but with party politics. The realigning of Texas's oil-lubricated moderate to conservative Democrats. His goal was a trifecta joining Texas, Florida, and California, oil, retirement centers, and aerospace, in a Sun Belt presidential and congressional alliance under a Republican banner. Their differences notwithstanding, Eisenhower, Johnson, and Nixon all illustrated the increasing salience of oil for post-World War II presidents. The depth of Nixon's commitment to this coalition became clear in his two sequential Texas strategies. Through 1969 and 1970, he sought the election of a moderate conservative, internationalist, pro-oil Republican to the Senate, Texas Congressman George H.W. Bush. Victory, it was thought, would immediately make the new senator a vice presidential possibility. Some of Nixon's early White House memos and discussions cited getting Bush elected as a reason for several of the administration's pro-oil positions. But in 1970, Bush's second defeat in the Texas U.S. Senate race, he had also lost in 1964, scotched that scenario. Nixon's follow-up from 1971 to 1974 directly aimed at luring part of Texas's Johnson-Connally Democratic faction into new majority Republicanism. Johnson was initially hostile. Connolly, though, took up the cudgels, signing on as Treasury Secretary in 1971, captaining Democrats for Nixon in the 1972 landslide, getting Nixon's backing to succeed Vice President Spiro T. Agnew in 1973, and winding up as the damaged president's preferred political heir for 1976. Watergate and Nixon's forced resignation destroyed any Connolly prospects, but the continuity is the message. Even in the face of Watergate and OPEC, Texas was always on Nixon's mind. But what neither Democrats nor Republicans expected until too late was so traumatic a watershed in the global oil business. The energy revolution of the 1970s, marked by the price of oil climbing from under $3 per barrel in 1970 to $31 in 1980, quickly forced strategic reappraisals. The new battle was defined in 1973 when Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and others in the cabinet promoted, just short of openly, a plan for using U.S. airborne forces to seize the oil fields of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Abu Dhabi. Years later, in 2003, after the second U.S. invasion of Iraq, old hands with good memories harked back to 1973 and began to talk of a 30-year war over Middle Eastern oil. It is just possible, as Chapter 3 will pursue, that the United States crossed a mid-1970s Rubicon in fateful response to a crush of related events. The topping out of U.S. oil production in its 1970 to 1971 Hubbert peak, multiple Middle Eastern nationalizations of Western oil interests, Iraq 1972, Libya 1975, Iran 1979, and the last surge of new OPEC members, the United Arab Emirates 1967, Algeria 1969, Nigeria 1971, and Ecuador 1973. Those years also saw the first OPEC price hikes, winter 1973 to 1974, and the Washington response of thinly veiled invasion threats in 1973 to 1975. When we look back on the three subsequent decades, it is now possible to describe a much grander convergence of forces. 1. Oil's ever-tightening grip on Washington politics and psychologies. 2. The cumulative destabilization of the Middle East. 3. The rise of varying degrees of radical Christianity, Judaism, and Islam around the world. 4. The biblical and geopolitical focus on Israel. And 5. The reemergence during the 1990s of Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and the Caspian Republics as the unstable but pivotal 30-nation borderlands of the vague Eurasian heartland strategically pinpointed by Sir Halford Mackinder, the British political geographer at the beginning of the 20th century. For our immediate purposes, however, it suffices to list the obvious new challenges and imperatives that pushed their way into 1970s political debate. One was the need to regularize world oil prices and get normal markets working again. Then there was America's pressing need to block Soviet ambitions in the Middle East and ensure its own access to the Persian Gulf, which became a staple of bipartisan assurance. A third concerned the various options for U.S. energy independence. Far-reaching conservation measures, stepped-up domestic oil production, emphasis on solar and other renewable energy sources, and the development of new, non-Middle Eastern petroleum sources. The fourth, a quiet imperative, was that OPEC uphold the dollar as the currency in which oil purchases had to be made, and then recycle the petrodollars thus earned through purchases of U.S. bonds and weapons systems. And, of course, Washington made it a priority to keep the Arabian Peninsula safe for the House of Saud, a close ally since World War II. Politically, all were spokes that led back to the same hub, petroleum. The 1980 race for the White House touched on these and two more immediate crises. 1979 had witnessed the seizure by radical Iranians of 53 American hostages, as well as the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, a potential move toward the Persian Gulf. In the Republican primaries, Texans Connolly and Bush squared off with ex-California Governor Ronald Reagan. The latter's easy victory over them, Texas oil men were prominent in his cheering section, quickly led to a new Lone Star State stratagem. Reagan picked Bush as his running mate, annoying conservative stalwarts, but reaching out to Texas and Eastern establishment interests alike. This was America's first national election focused on the Middle East and oil, and the Republican victory resonated. By the time Reagan and Bush sought re-election 4 years later, Texas, God-fearing, nationalist, and oil-rich, was the gleaming clip on three of the GOP's principal ideological suspenders: the Sun Belt, the Petroleum Belt, and the Bible Belt. As the grand old party became Houstonized, Fort Worthified, and Wacoed, the state stopped voting for Democratic presidents. California, by contrast, started backing them in 1992. The old Pacific command post of the Nixon and Reagan GOP, increasingly environmental and conservation-minded, had largely forgotten Oil Dorado and was becoming the mainstay of what conservatives called the Left Coast. And as the Cold War wound down in the 1990s, even California's mid-century aerospace plants, Navy yards, and military bases pointed west to face Imperial Japan, divided Korea, or demanding Vietnam, became ghosts of an electoral Christmas past. Economic and political heft slid toward the state's increasingly ascendant sectors: high technology and entertainment, industries in which chief executives frequently had ponytails, hosted liberal Democrats, and tagged companies with un-Republican names such as Yahoo, Google, Pixar, and DreamWorks SKG. Petro-diplomacy was peripheral to this worldview. Hubbard's Peak might as well have been a second echelon ski resort near Lake Tahoe. Nevertheless, by 2004, as George W. Bush claimed a second term in the White House, Wall Street, the religious right, and the military petroleum industrial complex were all eating at the same political table, although wise GOP strategists insisted on separate seatings. The father and son Bush presidencies had put a new interest group imprint on the Republican Party. Indeed, six of its seven presidential tickets between 1980 and 2004 had included a Bush, and five of those six had won. Even so, one family's prominence told only part of the tale. The Texification of America was the key ingredient. Yesteryear's Bush family bases in Ohio and Connecticut could not have sustained an oil-era dynasty. Texas now had the proper accent. During those same seven elections between 1980 and 2004, four different Lone Star State residents had gotten themselves on Republican or Democratic national tickets or become major independent nominees: both Bushes, Lloyd Benson, and Ross Perot. In 2000, GOP vice presidential nominee Dick Cheney, a Texas resident, would have been number five until he switched his domicile to Wyoming to sidestep the legal problem of a ticket having two Texans. As specified in the U.S. Constitution, the presidential electors from Texas could not have cast their votes for a Texan for president and a second Texan for vice president. Two different states had to be represented. No other state had anything like this access to power. Ronald Reagan had been the last of the Californians. National GOP politics had a new regional ladder, and government policymaking a new bias. By the turn of the century, in addition to becoming the second most populous state, Texas had also transformed itself into the most Republican of the top 10. A bulwark of party and ideological strength in Congress, as well as a major launching pad for capturing the White House. Texas Republicans and their compatriots in Alabama or Indiana increasingly spoke the same language. Quite literally, the lexicon of national politics had acquired an essential new prefix: Petro. Let's plot the path that took winners to the White House. Until mid-century, petroleum-related entries were rare on a presidential resume. One exception, James Garfield, had been an early northeastern Ohio oil investor before his election in 1880. The president chosen in 1928, Herbert Hoover of Iowa, was an industry intimate, a mining engineer who, in his earlier days, had undertaken oil surveys and even brokered a few South American properties to Standard Oil. A scholar to boot, he had translated into English the 1556 German-language masterwork in which the term petroleum first appeared in print. However little he understood the Great Depression, Hoover knew oil. But as we have seen, it took the deepening of the oil connection under Eisenhower, Johnson, Nixon, and Reagan to set the scene for petro-prefixes and Texification. In naming George H.W. Bush as his running mate in 1980, Reagan loosely followed Nixon's outline, enlisting not just a Texan, but the first full-fledged oil man to make a national ticket. 8 years later, when Bush became the first former oil executive to reach the White House, both major party tickets included an oil-savvy Texan. The Democratic vice presidential nominee, Senator Lloyd Benson, was an insurance company president with past petroleum corporate directorships. The press routinely characterized him as close to the oil industry. Through these years, oil's potent influence in U.S. politics was inadequately expressed by raw dollar tabulations. The $159 million the oil and gas industry gave to American politicians between 1990 and 2002, or the $256 million contributed by the transportation sector. What counted at least as much was the dearth of countervailing money or power. Thus, in one Washington showdown after another, oil could keep its tax breaks, coal-fired power plants could be exempted from clean air legislation, the auto industry could stave off tougher fuel efficiency standards, and oil and gas could beat back target dates for putting renewables like solar, wind, and water power into the U.S. energy mix. The influence built up over many decades can fairly be described as normally unbeatable. A first-class political, lobbying, and regulatory infrastructure. In fairness to U.S. industry, though, the political clout and periodic scandals of oil and gas are hardly limited to the United States. British Petroleum, for example, was linked to bribery in Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan in 2001 and 2002, and the Financial Times commented that while the days of government ownership have long passed, BP's ties with the British government are still so close that rivals call it Blair Petroleum. One Whitehall insider says there is a meeting of the minds between Tony Blair and Brown, Lord Brown, the BP chairman, who was a regular visitor to Downing Street. This rapport is reinforced by the presence on Brown's staff of former New Labour officials still close to number 10. Sarcastic references to Blair Petroleum, by no means a one-time barb, also appeared in The Guardian and The Scotsman, as well as in Germany's Der Spiegel and Russia's Pravda. Across the channel, 30 out of 37 senior executives of Total, the French oil giant, on trial in 2003 to 2004, were convicted of taking kickbacks and embezzlement. The evidence also made clear that Total, despite privatization, remained a principal arm of French intelligence for information and skullduggery in former French colonial Africa. The outraged judge who presided over the trial, Eva Joly, wrote a book entitled Is This the World We Want? About institutional corruption in the French Republic. Indeed, throughout Asia, Africa, and Latin America, the oil industry is so routinely associated with political corruption that the International Monetary Fund actually captioned research on one emerging African oil supplier, escaping the curse of oil? Not surprisingly, political and global forces also kept escalating the oil industry's ties to the U.S. presidency. In 1992, two of the three White House contenders were Texans. For all the billions that Ross Perot made in computers, after his 1988 sale of electronic data systems to General Motors, he diversified into real estate and oil and gas. The 1996 election, for its part, seemed to offer nary an oil man, but 2000's Republican ticket, Texas Governor George W. Bush and Halliburton Chief Executive Dick Cheney, was all oil. Two ex-oil company presidents on the same slate. Absolutely unprecedented, even if it had sidestepped being all Texan. Enterprising journalists found another petroleum connection to the Democratic nominee, two-term Vice President Albert Gore. Washington Post columnist David Ignatius frowned at the bizarre prospect of a presidential campaign in which three of the four candidates have intimate personal links to the oil business. Drawing on accounts of the Gore family, he told how Albert Gore Sr., as a Tennessee congressman in the 1950s, had taken a substantial profit from a cattle breeding partnership arranged by Occidental Petroleum Chairman Armand Hammer. After Gore Sr. left the Senate, Hammer made him chairman of Island Creek Coal, an Occidental subsidiary. The Gore connection, some believed, helped to constrain the FBI from investigating Hammer's controversial relationship with the Soviet Union. On taking up the Tennessee Senate seat, the younger Gore also took up the Occidental relationship. He received more than $300,000 through the early 1990s, his largest source of income outside his congressional salary, from a land deal his father had made with Hammer in 1973. While hardly a scandal, this background seems to have imposed a major inhibition. No Democratic nominee so entangled could easily confront the connections of the two oil sector Republicans, and despite some unusual openings, Gore held back. Those openings included a Bush political genealogy that on one side reached back to the controversial practices of Standard Oil in the Ohio of the 1900s, and on the other side, to Wall Street attempts to refurbish the post-World War I Soviet oil industry. Since Samuel S. Bush and George Herbert Walker a century ago, four generations of Bushes have worked in the oil business, the investment business, or both. I discussed this vocational embroilment and its presidential ramifications at length in my 2004 book, American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush, so I will only make brief mention here. More than any other U.S. political family, the Bushes exemplify the interaction of oil interests, the financial sector, the military-industrial complex, and the intelligence community. They have represented, arguably, they have also helped bring together the constituencies that the Republican National Coalition of the early 2000s has come to serve. First, however, we must lay an additional short track along which to follow the emergence of oil and its extraordinary relationship with both American foreign policy and the nation's intelligence community. Oil's unique role in U.S. foreign policy. By the time of the Civil War, oil had achieved a special relationship with Washington and its conduct of international relations. President Ulysses S. Grant, visiting in 1871, recalled for Pennsylvanians that the discovery and production of petroleum aided materially in supplying the sinews of war, and as a medium of foreign exchange, taking the place of cotton. With Southern commodities such as cotton unavailable for export markets, Abraham Lincoln's embattled government had counted on oil to procure foreign exchange and goods from European markets. Pennsylvania barrels, converted 42-gallon whiskey containers, filled in for Georgia bales. The war between the states was America's first war in which oil supplies became a target. In May 1863, 3,000 Confederate cavalry under General W.E. Jones raided the Burning Springs wells just outside of Parkersburg, West Virginia, and torched 150,000 gallons of the expensive, high-quality oil produced there. Such was the first flare of oil's strategic importance. John D. Rockefeller, in his 1909 Random Reminiscences of Men and Events, recalled, "One of our greatest helpers has been the State Department. Our ambassadors and ministers and consuls have aided to push our way into new markets in the utmost corners of the world." But he left out a key explanation for the government's interest. Standard Oil was the biggest U.S. company, putting 100 ships to sea, buying and selling oil in Latin America, Germany, and the Far East. It also operated a global intelligence system. By 1885, according to one historian, 70% of the Standard's business was overseas, and it had its own network of agents through the world, and its own espionage service to forestall the initiatives of rival companies or governments. Moreover, by 1909, oil was transcending its market as kerosene, the large but humdrum U.S. export of the fuel lamp era. Instead, as Germany built a Berlin to Baghdad railway and British admirals verged on a massive upgrading of their battle fleets by conversion from coal-fired to petroleum-burning engines, oil was truly marching as to war. From Pennsylvania and Texas to Romania and the Russian Caucasus, petroleum resources were shaping up as the new fulcrums of great power rivalry. While the admirals and generals plotted, the importance of Standard, Royal Dutch, and the smaller-scale Anglo-Persian multiplied. The course of empire could be altered if added speed and maneuverability from new oil-fired engines could someday allow Britain's 15-inch gunned Queen Elizabeth-class super-dreadnoughts to trap the Kaiser's coal-burning squadrons, or by some reverse scenario. Far in the background was another possibility still barely considered. Were American dominance of international oil production to continue and harden, power itself could migrate across the Atlantic. The years prior to 1914 saw sixpenny thrillers become current affairs manuals. Parliaments barely knew where secret services ended and oil company activities and munitions marketing began. The war itself raised control of petroleum to high strategy. In 1916, a British raid under Colonel Empire Jack Norton Griffiths crippled the Romanian oil fields before Germans took them in 1917. Berlin's oil-powered submarine warfare threatened vital Allied fuel deliveries, and 1918's last-minute Turkish drive to refuel the Central Powers was too late in capturing Russia's Baku oil fields. Combat did indeed become petroleum-centric in 1917 to 1918, once Allied trucks, tanks, airplanes, and gasoline, 80% of the fuel shipments in this period came from America, replaced wagons, cavalry, and horses. The armistice uncorked both celebrations and further schemes. Allied leaders boasted, in the words of French Premier Georges Clemenceau, that oil is as necessary as blood, or that the Allies floated to victory on a wave of oil, as phrased by a British War Cabinet member, Lord Curzon. However, for foreign offices, chancelleries, and state departments with eyes to read and ears to hear, the revelation of secret Franco-British plans to divide the resources of the Turkish Empire, along with U.S. political schemes in Mexico, another major producer, had their own urgency. The great post-war oil hunt had already begun. The governments of Britain and France, both wed to substantial state ownership and control of strategic oil resources, had colluded in the clandestine Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916 to carve up the post-war Middle East. France was to get primacy in Syria and Lebanon, while Britain took control of Mesopotamia and Jordan, with Palestine to be under international control. No change was made to London's existing sphere of influence in Persia and the Persian Gulf. Modified in private talks and at a post-war conference in San Remo, the reshuffling also proposed a more or less three-parts British, one-part French split of the oil resources in what became Iraq. To fulfill this arrangement, France got the German quarter share of the old Turkish Petroleum Company, while Britain kept most of the rest. Initially, the United States was to be excluded. The British moved to take charge in the Middle East. In 1918 to 1919, more than 1 million of His Majesty's forces had arrived to make up what became a de facto regional occupation force. Britain and France each dreamed of a Texas on the Tigris, pumping cheap fuel for automobiles, army motorized brigades, and the great battle fleets berthed in Toulon, Portsmouth, and Scapa Flow. As Chapter 7 will detail, there was also a sense on Britain's part, expressed with some candor by Prime Minister David Lloyd George, of returning to the Holy Lands in a modern-day crusader role. Post-war ambitions in London for a global oil coup, projects were also afoot in Latin America, Russia, and the Far East, also encompassed corollary hopes of countering the nascent U.S. challenge to British dominance in international finance. These machinations have been described with great elan and geopolitical detail in the many books dedicated to oil's grand, or not so grand, 20th century saga. In the 1920s, some of the more lurid titles of books on the subject described oil wars between the erstwhile allies. No one can mistake the nationalism and neo-mercantilism of the U.S. State and Commerce Departments during the post-war decade and into the 1930s. In 1921, the British ambassador to the United States, Sir Auckland Geddes, wrote to the Foreign Office about Washington's intentions to treat us as a vassal state so long as our £4.7 billion war debt remains unpaid. On the other hand, in 1919, Sir Edward Edgar, a figure in Royal Dutch Shell's Venezuela operations, had written in a British journal that 2/3 of the improved oil fields of Central and South America were passing into British hands, while the Shell group was prevailing elsewhere. America before long, contended Edgar, will have to purchase from British companies and to pay for, in dollar currency in progressively increasing proportion, the oil she cannot do without and is no longer able to furnish from her own store. Besides being naive, Edgar was impolitic. Still, Britain now took oil seriously. Also in 1921, Lord Curzon, Britain's foreign secretary, dismissed U.S. demands